Good morning. I'd just like to amplify what Roshi said about how wonderful it is for us all to be together. Little room. I'm going to be talking a little about intimacy today and maybe being in a hot, crowded room might feel a little too intimate. But walking around, I had a chance to see us all sitting together and then going back and finishing up the talk. There's someone writing, and the Tenzos are busy preparing our midday meal, and there's this whole symphony of practice going on, and to me, this, to my heart, this speaks of intimacy. So we hear a lot about intimacy. In fact, if you hang around Zen circles, you will quickly get very tired of hearing the word be intimate, not intimate enough, etc., etc. So, what is it to be intimate? I really kind of love the word because it means absolutely nothing. Leaves a wide open space for us to discover something about ourselves, to discover something about who we are, to discover something about our true nature. This intimacy, it's so elusive, but in the Dokusan room, it's unmistakable when it's there and when it's not there. And, the weird thing is it's nothing in particular. There's no particular way to be intimate. You can be intimate with a nod. You can be intimate pouring your heart out on the cushion in the Dokusan room. You can be intimate talking about how you want to save all beings, and not intimate at all doing any of those things. So intimacy, at least to me, it is not a thing. And, when we start out in practice, and it continues for many, many years and keeps continuing, we seem to be separate from true intimacy. And that sets up what I call the initial model, or in traditional Soto Zen terms, it's the first rank, the first position. And that model is one we're all familiar with. Intimacy, our true nature is something out there, and we got to drop all our crap in order to reach it. We have to clear away all the obstructions. We have to wake up and all of that Zen stuff that can be so tiresome sometimes. All of that comes from our basic feeling of separation from the Dharma, from our feeling that we are not intimate with the Dharma. And William Blake very eloquently captured this you know, this position that we're all familiar with. He said, if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. For man has closed himself up till he sees things through the narrow chinks of his cavern. So, initially this seems to be about some kind of cleansing process, dropping our ideas, dropping our conditioning, and if we're able to do that sufficiently, we're promised a reward. We're promised to be able to see things as they are, infinite. And there, you know, that is the absolute truth. There's nothing wrong with that, but it is a position, it's a perspective on the Dharma, and it's a perspective that is very dominant in the early stages of our practice. We're trying to drop our delusions, wake up, and achieve insight, kensho. And so one way to do that is, you know, to let go of thoughts and do a lot of zazen. Another way is apparently to take mescaline, which is what Aldous Huxley did. And he quoted William Blake in the title of a book he wrote about it called The Doors of Perception. And he talked about his experience of seeing things as they were, infinite, you know. And it doesn't sound that different from a lot of experiences that people have, you know, when they have powerful meditation experiences. Huxley said, my actual experience had been and was still of an indefinite duration, or alternatively, of a perpetual present made up of one continually changing apocalypse. So, perpetual present, not time moving on, but a perpetual present, changing moment after moment after moment, one perpetual apocalypse. So that sort of seems to be what we're shooting for in this particular perspective, dropping our conditioning, seeing things as they are, infinite. So the initial model is don't get bogged down in thoughts, let go of thoughts in zazen, get rid of thoughts, until eventually you break through. And that's good practice. But it's a perspective. So our delusions fall away suddenly. We have that big experience. It's so wonderful to see reality as it is, infinite, to see it straight on. And Gertrude Stein was a writer who was particularly good at using language to capture that straight on reality, just this. She famously wrote, rose is a rose is a rose. And that's from a poem she wrote, Sacred Emily. I'll just read a little more of it. Rose is a rose is a rose, loveliness extreme, extra gators, loveliness extreme, sweetest ice cream, page ages, page ages, page ages, wiped, wiped, wire, wire, sweeter than peaches and pears and cream. So we don't know exactly what this is, but we know it's alive. We know it's vivid. And we see the rose. Just parenthetically, she was very, very good at directly encountering her experience and finding language to convey that directness. She wrote, and this was the first time anyone, she was homosexual, and this was the first time we believe that anyone wrote about homosexual experience this way. She wrote, "They were gay. They learned little things that are things in being gay. They were quite regularly gay." Well, that's from something she wrote called Miss Fur and Miss Skeen. And Edmund Wilson believes that's the first time in English that the word gay was used to refer to love between members of the same sex. Now, Gertrude Stein was not a modest person, and when her line, "Roses is a rose is a rose," took off, she said about it, "Now listen, I'm no fool. I know that in daily life we don't go around saying, 'Izza, Izza, Izza.' Yes, I'm no fool, but I think in that line the roses red for the first time in English poetry for 100 years. She called this conveying the excitingness of pure being, things as they are, just as they are, infinite. But, just as they are empty, which means they don't have any inherent essence or nature, and they change according to causes and conditions. So, yes, the rose is red at that moment, but in January, the rose is brown and dead. Right now, the rose is machine noise coming up from Broadway. Stein held up a rose. Shak Yamuni held up a flower and transmitted the Dharma to Mahakasyapa. But what is the transmission now? So, 1700 years after Shak Yamuni held up the flower, and about 1,200 years before Stein held up the rose, the great master Nan Chuan and his student, Officer Liu Gang, were walking in the garden. And Officer Liu Gang said to Nan Chuan, "You know, this teaching master Zhao, he was quite extraordinary. He was able to say, 'Heaven and earth have the same root. Myriad things are one body.' Isn't that terrific?" And Nan Chuan pointed to a peony in the garden and said, "People today see this flower as if in a dream." So we can see pretty readily what this is like from the initial position, from the first position. Hey, you know, those are just words on paper that you're babbling at me. Drop all your ideas about the Dharma and look at this peony. Peony is a peony is a peony. And that certainly is one perspective, the perspective from the first position. Drop it and see it for real. But the pointer to this koan is a bit more inclusive than this first position way of looking at things. The pointer, which in these koan collections is an introduction to what the koan is about, says, Yangshan takes a dream for reality. Now I have to explain a little. Yangshan was the hero of the koan just before this in the collection, and he goes up to heaven and has a Dharma experience, which the koan talks about. So Yangshan, in his dream, goes to heaven. All right, so the pointer says, Yangshan, the master in the previous koan, takes a dream for reality. Nanchuan, the master in this koan, points to wakefulness as unreal. If one knows that wakefulness and dreaming are fundamentally non-existent, for the first time one will believe that unreality and reality are absolute. And then he gets to the crux of the matter. He says, but tell me, what eye does this person have? What eye does this person have who is attached to neither dreaming or reality, neither to waking up or being asleep, neither to delusion nor enlightenment? How does he see things? What kind of eye does he have? And the founding Chinese teacher of our school pointed directly to the type of eye that this person has. He says that when you see with the eye, you can't get it. When you see with the ear, then you get it. So what type of eye is this? It's the eye that can see Mozart in a sunset. It's the eye that can hear God in a shout in the street. It's the eye that can be intimate with our own estrangement from intimacy, our own feeling that we're not enough, that we're not getting it, that we're separate from the Dharma. So it's not that the initial perspective, the one of dropping delusions and attaining insight, is wrong, but we have to keep in mind that all these perspectives, in addition to this one of the eye that I've just been discussing, are empty. They're not fixed landing fields that we come down and, okay, we're there. In traditional Soto teaching, there's five of these different positions, and they're a mess. They flow into each other, they blur into each other, and as soon as you think, I'm in the fifth position, it's already the first position. You've attained something. So it's very subtle, very blurry, and very, it's just not something to grab onto, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So back to this position of the eye, which I think of as being the third position in conventional Soto teaching. What happens from the first position is the self becomes blurrier and blurrier, and the present moment that we're supposed to return to in the first position starts falling away because we realize we've never left and that there was no one to leave in the first place. And when we reach this position, being on the breath in mindfulness training is the blooming of Stein's rose. And the thought that comes up and supposedly distracts us from the breath is the blooming of Stein's rose. And the letting go of the thought and returning to the breath, the return, is the blooming of the rose. Nothing but blooming, and no one, nothing to bloom. This is emptiness. This is the position where emptiness comes front and center, and the relative, the good and bad, illusion and enlightenment, you know, attain enlightenment, drop delusion, all that side of things temporarily takes a back seat. The bright day world goes behind the moon like it does in a total eclipse. And all there is this blooming of the rose. And from this perspective, we're really able to get a taste of intimacy, because if we realize it as the blooming of the rose, the blooming of the Dharma, the blooming of the no-self that we are, then there's nothing to drop. There's nothing to be self-conscious about. There is no holding back from the joy, from the blooming, from the decay, from the depression, from the tediousness, from the heat, from the cold, to the feeling of inadequacy. There's no holding back from any of it, because from this position we can perceive it with the eye that sees it as the blooming of the Dharma. This is freedom. From here we can preach the Dharma 24 hours a day and never open our mouth. We are free to speak or not, think or not think. There is no place to land. And more to the point, not only is there no place to land, but we are very, very happy that this is so. So from this position, far from being trapped by our thinking, from our conditioning, our thinking and our conditioning are perceived as the Dharma itself. We can just allow it to flow. We find intimacy with ourselves and others. You know, there's an old song by the Mills Brothers. Some of you might remember them. Which I think really shows what we can find in this position. The song is nothing but a bunch of thoughts. It's the kind of daydream we fly into in our cushion despite our best intention. And the song goes like this. It's very simple. The moonlight's shining bright upon the Wabash. From the fields there comes a scent of new mown hay. From the fireside the candlelight is gleaming. On the banks of the Wabash, far away. He's not on the Wabash. He's not seeing any of this. He's off in a dream. Just like Nan Chuan says people these days fly into. He's off in a dream. He's feeling the homesickness welling up from his heart. He's being intimate with the Dharma, not in terms of mindfulness training or the first position. If he were in that position, he would let go of those thoughts and he'd return to the breath. But there is nothing outside the Dharma. There's nothing to depart from or to return to. And so this person, through his thought constructs, through his daydream, is being intimate with his homesickness and longing. And when we are intimate with our homesickness and longing, truly, we are already home.